Okay.
Well, everyone, hello.
Welcome back.
What is this podcast?
It's Another Look with Will and Corey.
That's right. Hey, Corey, welcome.
Hello, Will.
What are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about Alfred Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief.
Ooh.
From 1955. And, you know, this turned out to be an interesting triptych with these first three episodes of season three.
Yeah.
Hail Caesar being the production side of the movie industry from the 50s. The Long Day Closes taking place in the 50s about, you know, someone who is like a movie lover. And then here's a movie that Bud could maybe have seen, or, you know, Capitol Pictures maybe could have made in To Catch a Thief. Super breezy romp through the French Riviera.
Yeah, I'm really happy you chose this one because, you know, as this podcast, the thesis or the general methodology of this podcast is to talk about things that don't always get the spotlight. But we also have a tendency to be like, well, I like this movie a lot, so I'm going to pick it. You know, not even considering, like, you know, the context or how well it's received now. But I do think this was a good pick because I'm not sure how many people revere it in the way that maybe the top tier Hitchcock movies are revered nowadays.
For sure.
So I think in general Hitchcock is kind of just accepted as a great director, and you don't hear the talk as much. I'm not seeing a lot of like young like Letterbox kids getting into like Blackmail or watching The Lady Vanishes. It'd be cool if they were, but like I definitely think like Hitchcock's reputation hasn't gone down, but it's just kind of been dormant for a while. So I'm excited to talk about, like, not one of his lesser known pictures, but maybe one that isn't always considered in the upper echelon, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I am curious, like, why this one? What led you to pick To Catch a Thief for this episode?
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking of, like, I don't know, stuff that I've seen. I was looking through my collection and, you know, this kind of popped out. And I remember watching it for the first time like a few years ago, probably within 5 or so years or something, but just how gorgeous it looks. And it's just like fun.
Yeah.
And Cary Grant is awesome. And Grace Kelly is like one of the most beautiful people to ever exist. You know, Cleopatra, Grace Kelly, Margot Robbie.
It's a good list.
Kind of ends there. no, but just like fun movie. And then, yeah, Hitchcock to you know, get one of his movies in here, but then not something that's an obvious pick like Psycho or The Birds or Vertigo.
Yeah, which we... To let our listeners know, we did watch Vertigo right after watching this movie. We did a double feature because Corey had never seen Vertigo.
It was my first time watching Vertigo for the
If you want to give through. Give a quick capsule take on what you thought of Vertigo, it can be as short as it was fine or it was good or it was bad. I doubt you thought of two of those three, but
dude, Vertigo is kind of brutal, like the end.
Yeah.
The ending is abrupt in a way that was like, I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Jeez. But incredible movie. I didn't, you know, I expected it to be a little more horror or like thriller. I guess it is. It felt more like a drama.
Yeah.
About mental health, you know. The thing that I really thought was interesting was like right when you get like the case or whatever of, you know, the guy's wife, when he tells Jimmy Stewart like she's possessed or something, and then when we get the chance to meet that character and Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak are when they're talking, it's like thinking of this scene as being like, if they didn't already mention that possession thing, like the supernatural element would not be there at all. This would just be like a straight up drama. And but just that little mention changes the whole like texture of the movie, where it's like what's and you don't even need to add anything to the movie. Like, there's no ghosts, mm-hmm. you know, there's no, like, it's all psychological from that one, you know, from the one, like, suggestion that maybe she's possessed, you know? So now yeah. you're, like, watching everybody, and then Jimmy Stewart is suffering from vertigo, which is, like, you know, a brain thing or whatever, body thing. So it's, like, an internal thing that you just have to assume he's dealing with.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's, like... It's not just like easily cured. So it's an interesting like supernatural element to the movie, which I thought was smart because there's like nothing else to the supernatural part of your, you know, like the theme or anything. It's just all like now it's all in our heads as the viewer to be like, is she crazy? Like,
yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
No, I'm really happy you found a lot to it. I mean, Vertigo is canon. You know, it's like mm-hmm. the top tier of American cinema. It is one of the great works of art that the silver screen has ever seen. You know, it's yeah. like that's not being, you know, that's a little bit of hyperbole. But when you mm-hmm. watch it, like I find it endlessly mysterious. Mm-hmm. Every time I watch it, I feel like I come away with more questions than answers, which is super important because as much as it does give you a really solid resolution, the mechanics of how this movie's put together and the way that Hitchcock tells you this story is so like you just feel like there's dead ends everywhere and it's you know, in spite of you saying it's like not scary, I find it more and more as I watch it very spooky. Mm-hmm. It's just like a film about the obsession of the mind is like really really important. Mm-hmm. And to watch it after this one to bring it back to Catch a Thief mm-hmm. is interesting because I love this film. I love To Catch a Thief. You know, it's not quite like in like I said, in like my top favorites of Hitchcock. Yeah. But what it does give me is, like you said, like a very relaxed, just like non-confrontational vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no seeds of like Jimmy Stewart dragging Kim Novak up the stairs being like, yeah. this is where she died. You know, like
right.
there's like none of this like intense like psychological torment, or, you know, not even pushing to like his pure horror pictures like Psycho, where it's like murder and treachery and split personality and like all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. With To Catch a Thief, it's the beach. It's the farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lavish hotels on the beach at Nice. It's drives up in the country while looking for a summer home. You know, it's pure vacation vibes. It's one of those movies that when you watch it, you're like, okay, so they took a vacation first, and then we're like, how can we get this as a tax benefit? Oh, let's make a movie.
Yeah.
And we'll just, you know, we'll fly in Grace Kelly, we'll fly in Cary Grant, we'll shoot it for a week and a half, mm-hmm. we're set. I mean, it probably took a little longer than that, but it does feel very tossed off, but in a way that I find very pleasurable.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy it.
It's an interesting double feature. Mm-hmm. And I think they work really well. They're both in VistaVision.
Oh my god,
which is insane in both movies.
VistaVision is just lovely. Lovely.
It's like IMAX.
It's IMAX.
It should be. It's basically they made it in IMAX.
A24 has been talking about putting some of their early films back on IMAX, like Ex Machina, Hereditary. Really? Yeah, it's like going to happen at some point this year. So some of their big classics, Uncut Gems is going to go on there, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They should just like cancel that and just bring all the VistaVision movies back to IMAX restorations, because when you're saying that this is IMAX, it totally is. Like all these some of the establishing shots, some of the helicopter shots of the vistas of, you know, hee hee ha ha, of VistaVision. Like there's that scene where the cops are following him. And they're like winding among the French, you know, hills near the beach, and it's that helicopter is so far away.
Yeah,
like the cars aren't even like in the bottom half of the frame. Like they're just like kind of down there.
Yeah,
and it's like the movie telling you like, yeah, like he's getting chased. Just look at the pretty pictures.
Yeah,
like it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, look where we are.
Yeah, like just like enjoy the. the heat, the heat and the warmth of a vacation that you can take in an air-conditioned theater right now.
The other interesting thing, and just to get off Vertigo, but like the way, you know, the end of To Catch a Thief has like a rooftop scene, and then the beginning of Vertigo has a rooftop scene.
It was kind of a perfect
combo.
Yeah.
And totally different feels. Like, this would be a really good double feature for anyone out there who wants to give it a go, because you get this first movie, it's nice and breezy, To Catch a Thief, you know, it's just like, it's just nice. Yeah. And then Vertigo's like, Vertigo's that Hitchcock shit you want, you know? So,
yeah,
it's, yeah, really cool.
I do kind of want to start by going through a little bit of Hitchcock's filmography, because I'm not going to read like what essentially everything looks like through like the early 30s up to the mid 70s when his final film was Family Plot. But
that's crazy.
If we start with To Catch a Thief in 1955, just 1 year before, he made two pictures, Dial M for Murder and Rear Window, same year.
Yep. Also great.
Already, like, nuts, right?
Yeah, both of those are just iconic.
In the same year as To Catch a Thief, 1955, he made The Trouble with Harry. In 1956, he made The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is a remake of his 34 film, and The Wrong Man, both in 1956. And then he took a two-year break to make Vertigo.
Damn.
So it's like, the fact that just in that three-year stretch, he made five pictures is insane. You know, like the level that this guy was operating at, especially when like none of these pictures he wrote, you know, he just took these scripts and shaped them into something that isn't just recognizable, but also like vividly part of like, I don't know, cinematic language, like something when it is described as Hitchcockian, it's because most of the time people are recognizing something that can be translated in a modern context. You know, it's often Hitchcockian is used a little too much, you know. It's like he wasn't the only guy making suspense pictures, but there is a little bit of an image or an idea about what the Hitchcock brand is that has translated to many films across cinema history. But to think about how To Catch a Thief is just a little blip in this, it does make you feel like, okay, it's like, what's so special about To Catch a Thief?
Totally.
But there is a lot to this movie that I really enjoy. It's very easy and easily recognizable.
Okay, the thing about To Catch a Thief, this viewing was, what's Hitchcock about this movie? You know, because it's like not a horror movie.
Right.
You know, so it's like, where's the suspense going to be? And that's really, I think, like the main Hitchcock thing is like the bomb under the table. You know? And wasn't that from The Show? Wasn't that from an episode of The Show, not one of his movies?
I don't know where that was originated from. I think that was an example he gave at some point.
Oh, okay.
Was like, if it, like, there's a difference between like a surprise and suspense. If a bomb blows up without you knowing that there was a bomb there, that's a shock.
Yeah.
That's a surprise. But if you show the audience that there's a bomb and then the people sit down at the table, then you're wondering, okay, so we know about this. They don't. So we are in a position where we are worried for them because we are in a, we are like at an advantage, essentially.
That's what made Oppenheimer so thrilling too, like the first half, or, you know,
and
seeing that for the first time, being like, the whole, this whole movie is about a bomb about to go off, you know? So it's like, we're starting, before you even start the movie, it's like, you know, it's about a bomb.
Yeah, the suspense is there from the first,
mm-hmm.
you know, from the first frame of that movie,
yeah.
for sure. And that's like a common, you know, kind of, I think, a, like a cinematic, not a trope, but like an a sense of... a sense of awareness, I think. A lot of directors want to keep that in mind when they make movies, to just, you know, have the audience be in on the picture and give them a sense of involvement in the narrative, right? And Hitchcock does this better than anyone. You know, and it's like in this movie, To Catch a Thief, it is very much a variation on his Wrong Man series of films, which is where someone is accused of something that they didn't do, or it was someone who was a reformed a reformed thief or a reformed, you know, something. And yeah. they are accused of their past, and their past yeah. becomes a problem. To Catch a Thief is like this. Cary Grant was a master jewel thief at one point,
yeah.
stole from rich people along the French Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, he decided, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, yeah. I'm going to retire and have a garden and just, mm-hmm. you know, just live life normally. Now someone is come back into the fold and is copying all of his moves.
Mm.
And the police are on his trail because back then, who else are you going to blame except the person that was yeah. doing it for 10 years?
And especially he's living where these things are happening.
Yep.
So it's like, oh, it has to be him, mm-hmm. you know, the cat yeah. burglar. And we get a little bit of his backstory, too, where he talks about after he was a thief, he, like, joined the resistance
yep.
because he wanted to, like, undo his wrongs or whatever. Or he wanted to give something back, you know. And then the guy he's talking to is like, did you ever kill anybody? And then he goes, 72 people. Or, you know, he's just like...
This is very much a post-war movie, not like immediately after World War II. It came out, you know, 10 years later.
Sure.
But the idea of like, what does the past mean to people, especially with like the past like that?
Yeah.
You know, so like, kind of a consideration of that is essential to the context of this movie.
And the way that that gets dropped in there, though, is like. It's still in this, like, flippant, or not flippant totally, but it's just like, he's not going to murder anybody.
No.
Or, you know, like...
It was wartime. Why not?
This movie doesn't feel like it's going to get murdery or, like, any more serious than it ever gets.
Murdery is a good term. It doesn't get murdery.
Like, one person dies yeah. in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's, like... opportunities for deaths to happen,
mm-hmm.
but then the rest of the movie just feels like a little more fun.
Or it like, is so light,
it,
like
it's
and
light,
bubbly, like
yeah,
like the
breezy.
There's an entire scene where like he's on the beach, and there's a guy like watching him and like keeping tabs mm-hmm. on him on mm-hmm. the beach, and then he goes and changes and gets out of his beach clothes and he goes to a restaurant,
yeah.
and then he gets on a boat. You know, it's like Cary Grant. It's like they told Cary Grant, okay, you can be on vacation for 2 weeks, but in these certain locations, you can have to say these lines and we're going to have a camera around.
Yeah.
It's almost like they didn't even tell him he was making a movie. He's so tan and leathery in
oh
this.
Oh my God. Men were just older at younger ages back
like, I don't, he must be like 24 here. I'm making a joke.
No, for sure.
No, it's like there is a sense of... men eating nothing but like steak and like baked potatoes and then drinking nothing but like whiskey and yeah. gin
yeah.
that leads to a man looking like this like mm-hmm. when he's not even like probably 50 years old.
Yeah, you're on the beach, you're in the sun, you're beautiful.
He's like
know.
Cooking like a turkey.
Yeah.
This. But he is incredibly suave.
Yeah.
One of the best actors ever.
Mm-hmm.
And he holds this movie very well. His poise, he's very like elusive and sneaky
yeah.
as a master thief mm-hmm. should be.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his interplay with Grace Kelly is fantastic
yeah.
and charming and like the right side of sexy. It's not
yeah.
like really intense, but like mm-hmm. it's like fun enough to keep everybody on their toes.
Yeah,
it's very Soderbergh. I'm sure Steven Soderbergh has watched this
yeah.
countless times.
Yeah, it's flirty.
It's flirty. Like, you think, it makes me think of the Soderbergh pictures, like Out of Sight or like Ocean's
mm-hmm,
11,
mm-hmm,
or like there's mm-hmm. like fun little flirtatious moments, but it, you know, it doesn't really like take on a, you know, it's not like it's a romance per se.
Yeah.
It's like what it is more of just a, you know, like a crime film with like a fun layer of like sensuality underneath
yeah.
it. So,
yeah.
I really enjoy just like how this movie is put together. It's like so easy to watch.
I didn't know it was originally a novel by David Dodge written in 1952.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, watching this, feeling like this is very Bond. You know?
Yeah.
And, Casino Royale, the first Bond book, was written in 1953.
Wow.
So, like,
Yeah.
When was the
Ian
first...
Fleming could see the vibe in the air. He was like, I know what people want. Mm-hmm. I get it.
And I wonder if they're like writing them at the same time and they just happen to come out, and not like Ian Fleming read To Catch a Thief and was like, ooh, I'm going to make something a little more espionage or whatever. I'm sure it was like happening at the same time. They just came right. out. But
there is a sense of what Bond does differently, though, that I feel like this doesn't do. Where this is like set in essentially in one location,
yeah.
one city. Mm-hmm. They might go to another city, but it's all the south of France,
yeah.
French Riviera, you know, just like lavish beach towns and fancy restaurants, nice hotels, things like that. Whereas Bond is all about the globe trotting. You know, it's like he may stay in one location for like half the movie, but usually the beginning is at a different location, mm-hmm. and he goes to London to get his assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the best Bond films, at least the ones that I love the best, it's like we're hitting a new spot every 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go there, we get a mm-hmm. sequence, we get some character development. That takes us to the next mm-hmm. next country, the next continent, wherever mm-hmm. we're going. So like this one's like it's like low key. It feels like almost like a very early like in development version of what Bond became, I guess.
Yeah.
And not that like Cary Grant doesn't feel like a suave, like he's just like a chill guy, and he like likes Grace Kelly's character,
mm-hmm.
and he's not mean. He's not like an asshole like Bond is.
Yeah.
So there are some key differences, but I also get. I see the vibe of like what this was trying to go for, you know,
totally.
And that's what Bond was going for too. The color, the adventure, you mm-hmm. know, the '50s was all about getting people away from their television sets and into the theater. And mm-hmm. this movie and like VistaVision, that's like what this is. It's movie.
Oh my God. And the
like capital
and,
M
dude and Technicolor.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck it. you're done.
Game over.
Dude, for real. This movie is so beautiful. To Catch a Thief is like, it has some incredible textures and like, and the costumes are awesome too.
Oh
and the colors and the costumes and like the interiors and stuff that I'm feel like I'm going to keep going back to Vertigo, even though I said I wasn't going.
That's
to.
Okay.
But there's that's that okay. one interior in Vertigo that's like all red.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, ooh,
Ernie's. Yeah.
Damn.
Mm-hmm.
VistaVision.
No, it's
Technicolor.
In terms of like, what this movie doesn't really have going for it is like a level of polish that Vertigo might have compared to or even other Hitchcock films. It's kind of sloppy. A lot of the like compositing or whatever they were using when he's on the rooftops doesn't work that well.
Yeah, you can tell the backgrounds.
The ending kind of
like a mat
when he's like climbing on the roof and stuff. That I like. It's fun, but it's like so low key that it's kind of almost like boring a little bit.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah.
I love this movie, but there is like a sense of like Hitchcock was kind of walking through this.
Sure.
But like that creates its own pleasures too. It's
yeah.
not just there's not just bad things that come with that. Like
yeah.
I wrote in my notes more mm-hmm. travelogue than adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Which like it's kind of just about you like looking at the mm-hmm. colors
yeah.
and experiencing just like the landscapes
yeah.
and just like enjoying a fun little romp.
Yeah.
It there's no, the danger is so low key.
Yeah.
Like the scariest things that happen in this, besides like the climactic, like we're hanging off of a rooftop kind of a thing,
yeah.
is these old ladies walking into their bedrooms going, "My diamonds!
Yeah,
my diamonds!"
Yeah,
you know.
The movie starts with like. Mm-hmm. A lady screaming.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there's something before that. I think that's like a little bit of like, it's like a newspaper or something.
It's like a series of burglaries that we're seeing.
Yes.
And,
that's
but
right,
we
that's
never
right.
see the burglar, and it's these fades in and out
yeah.
of the cat walking yeah. on the roof.
Yeah. You see the cat, you see some hands.
Yeah.
You see the cat exiting. Yeah. And then like, it immediately is like, and even like the shot before the scream kind of like sets you up for this jump scare a little bit, even though it's like not, it's more just like you're gonna flinch at a loud sound no matter when it happens,
right.
you know? So it's like, but I thought that was cool because it's like, it's immediate and you just get right into the story.
Yeah.
It's like some shit's getting stolen. It's probably this guy. He's saying it's not. And now he's got to figure out how to, like, clear his name.
Yeah. Hitchcock's films were always very simple in the sense that, you know, the narrative progression is clear as day.
Yeah.
You know, it's that Hollywood, that Hollywood construction, that continuity puts it all together in a very readable, translatable way. Mm-hmm. But what makes his films great in his finest pictures are, you know, it's like that subtextual, uncomfortable elements, stuff that later directors would pull out and make more overt, you know, the stuff that you see in The Birds, in Psycho, in Vertigo, which then becomes, you know, movies like, you know, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff like that. You know, he was, Hitchcock was starting the genesis for a lot of these movies, but it was so buried in the style and mores of the time that you couldn't really do a lot with it. But he does a lot with a little. And that you're absolutely right with that opening scene.
An interesting thing about the Technicolor, too, is like, so Psycho's after this in 60. And that's black and white.
Yeah.
So it's like,
shot it cheap with like his TV crew, like just real quick and dirty. And that's what that movie deserves, honestly. Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting because that feels like it's before this movie. And I guess it's the black and white that's like cueing me. You know, where I'm like looking up, oh, what was the history of color film? And then I see this still from 1902 that was like an experimental color. And I'm like, what? Color wasn't even like part of real life until the 50s, the 40s, you know?
Yeah.
Everything pre-1940 was black and white in real life. That's just how I know it to be. Now the world's in color.
Yeah.
And it's great. But it's interesting, you know, the choice of doing black and white. And I think you mentioned one idea of getting around the censors with the blood, because then like it wouldn't be red in Psycho.
Yeah, I don't know if that was a conscious choice, but I mean, with a scene like the shower scene in 1960.
Yeah.
Like, you know, of course, it's all implied. It's all about the cuts. The editing in that scene gives you a sense of feeling violated, of being, you know, you feel like you're being stabbed watching that scene. And with the music, the combination is just incredibly scary. But you don't see anything. The closest thing you see is like a close-up of Marion Crane's stomach as the knife is approaching her stomach, but you do not see I don't think you even see the knife touch the skin. So it's just this idea, the image of like the knife getting close and then cutting to her like, you know, flailing her arms and the shot of the blood running down the drain and then her falling out. It's incredibly well edited, and it gives you this illusion of truly watching the most violent thing in the world.
Yeah.
But it's of course not that, and very tame by modern standards.
Sure.
But it's interesting that, yeah, like I love it when directors go back to black and white after a history of color, especially when you do color like this. If you make Vertigo, oh my God, and then you go back to Psycho and you shoot in black and white, there's an artistic reason for that, of course.
Yeah. Just like Clerks.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like artistic and practical.
Yeah, like, there's an idea of like, you know, low budget choosing black and white because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. And there's also like, I'm an established director. I can do basically whatever I want. And I'm choosing black and white because it's going to work for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's there's many ways that you can go about that.
Yeah.
You know, John Ford went back to black and white for The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, yeah.
After shooting The Quiet Man, The Searchers, color films that glow off the screen.
Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting when directors make those choices, not to, I wouldn't call it regress, not to go back, but to change, to make that aesthetic leap again.
Oh, you know, and even like modern stuff like Godzilla Minus One, minus color.
Yep.
You know, or how they re-release Parasite in black and white.
Yep. Logan.
Mad Max, Fury Road, you know, like the black and chrome version of that. Like, that's interesting because Fury Road is an incredibly Technicolor film, too.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah, the highlights on the flame and the desert.
Yeah, just like all the colors.
Like, that's exactly what you want to see when you watch Fury Road. But I will say, when I watched the black and chrome version, I was struck by what Black and White does. You know, it doesn't always do this, but it does pare it down. It brings it down to a like more elemental level. Yeah. That's clearly what George Miller was going for when he did that. But it makes you think less about the spectacle and more about the moving parts in the image. Like, you focus on everything.
Mm.
You just, everything catches your eye in Black and White. Every change of the shadow, of a character entering the room, what they do in the frame, what's happening, all of that is like so much more, I don't know, like central to the narrative. So when you watch, you know, you watch something like this, To Catch a Thief, it's all just flamboyant color, just like popping off the screen. The little details don't matter as much. You know, that and I think the style reflects that. Like, you know, there's the scene where he's talking with like his contact about people who are jewel thieves and like like the people who have had like, who has their stuff like stolen in the past and who's like could be a target for the next thief, so he can like catch them in the act, right? They're walking through a flower market, like a garden, essentially in the streets of the city, and it is like almost impossible to listen to what they're talking about because the color's so vivid.
Yeah.
And we're just watching it on Blu-ray. I've heard the 4K has some problems color timing wise, but like, you know, if they would have done this 4K right, I mean, like, I don't think I could watch the movie at all. I'd just be like drooling looking at the color
of
the
floor. I gotta close my eyes.
It's like, it's too bright. The colors.
The colors, Duke. The colors.
I really like the grandeur. Squinted the grandeur, right? Oh,
dude, yeah.
No.
Fucking movies, dude.
But like,
I love it.
I also wanted to bring up the Hitchcock cameo in this.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But remember how in Go Back to Vertigo, I'm not going to do it anymore after this. Hitchcock's cameo in Vertigo is literally him just walking across the frame.
I missed
it. You didn't even see him. And I think he's wearing a hat. So it's like his portrait or like what we know of him isn't as immediately recognizable.
Yeah.
And that like, I don't know, it sometimes reflects like what he feels like about the movie. Like that was right at the beginning, out of the way. Like,
yeah.
Like don't even like that. This is, I don't want you taken out of the story at all. Mm-hmm. But I want to be in there.
Yeah,
you know, I want
an Easter egg.
Yeah, a little thing. This he's a whole gag.
Yeah.
Like he's in the Cary Grant is in the back of the car and he's evaded the police. He sent his housekeeper in his car and she goes into town. The police chase her. They find out it isn't him. They go back to the house, but at that point he's on a bus into the city.
Yeah.
And he's on the bus and there's a lady in the back with a bird, and Cary Grant like looks at the lady with the bird,
and you see like these two birds in a cage, and maybe that's like some metaphor or whatever for like, you know, his freedom or something.
Yeah, he's starting to feel trapped again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it pans over to Hitchcock. And he's just like there, and the music does a little da-da-da or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to the next scene, and it's like, it couldn't be more obvious that it's him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they're not, his cameos aren't like that. You know, they're very subtle. So that was another thing that made me think about the general vibe of this movie, which is just, it's a fun little lark.
Mm-hmm. I remember bringing up wanting to watch this one to you, and you were like, oh, it's just like a Hitchcock on vacation, you know? It's like, yeah, man,
he really took a vacation making this. And I don't, it sounds kind of, I don't know, a little bit kind of putting it down, but it's like that's why this movie works. Not every movie needs to be this harrowing experience or this emotionally, you know, limitless melodrama. You know, not everything needs to give me everything that I could ever want from a movie. Sometimes this is enough.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the lighting, like, in the 50s. You know, I feel like, okay, decades of time are actually 20-year spans, I was thinking. It's like they're, you know, the 10 years that they are, so like 50 to 59.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then they're also 5 years on either end.
Yeah.
You know, so like stuff that's happening in the 40s finally gets like interpreted into the 50s, you know, and then stuff that's happening in the 50s gets interpreted into the 60s. Like
right.
we, you know, we're a little bit behind sometime in like interpreting these things that are happening in the world or whatever, or the way we're reacting to new developments in humanity. So like, I want to say the 50s are like maybe my favorite decade for movies, because I just find like so many movies I am intrigued by, and then I see they're from the 50s, and then I watch them and I'm like, God damn it, this was great. Mm-hmm. But then there's like, there's a bunch from the 40s, you know, that are like good. And then there's some in the early 60s too that are like, you know, so those play into the 50s. Like the late 40s is 50s, the early 60s is the 50s too.
I definitely see that, because it does take time for a new decade to like find itself.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then once it finds itself, people are like, they realize that they're there in this like place and they want more, or things change, war happens, you know, like so many different things in the 50s and 60s affected what those decades were. So when you think about To Catch a Thief, it's interesting that it feels, besides the post-war like talk in the movie, it feels divorced from any sort of like context. If you take it away from like, if you take it away from the like the VistaVision, like we're bringing movies back to the big screen.
Movies are back.
Yeah, forget about your television. Don't you want to look at beautiful French locales for 90 minutes? Grace Kelly in Technicolor? Game over.
Over it.
Game over.
The color and like the lighting too, the thing I love about the lighting from this era of filmmaking is like, it's lighting for film, so you need like a ton of lights, and it feels like very stagey. Mm-hmm. Even though they're outside, you know, you can still see like the halo highlight on their hair or whatever, you know, and some of the scenes feel just like, oh, this is the sun lighting it, you know, but I'm sure they had other lights too, and that's just kind of crazy thinking of like lights outside also to just make this even more sumptuous. Oh man, this movie's so sumptuous.
Sumptuous is a good word for it.
But like the color too, and the lighting, you know, we were talking about, feels very like early giallo films. Yep. You know, and we were referencing Blood and Black Lace, and I feel the same way about when I watch Mario Bava's Blood and Black Lace, which is from 1964, so it's basically the 50s. Like I remember having the same feeling with Blood and Black Lace and being like, look at this shot. It's like, it's in the daytime, but I can tell that there's like backlight, you know, and fill lights and stuff. And you can just tell that there's like lighting all over the place to like, to really just put so much into the frame really, or, you know, and it's cool for movies to like be more realistic, you know, where it's like, practical lighting,
something
Barry that, Lyndon.
Yeah, that something resembles the reality that we see.
Yeah. Like, let's light this with NASA lenses so we can get literally candlelight, you know, from Barry Lyndon.
Incredible.
Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. Mm-hmm. Fucking outrageous.
Beautiful movie.
But yeah, that was like, that was an interesting thing, kind of making the connection to like the giallo stuff. And see, you know, because there's a lot of like greens and oranges in this movie, and, you know, reds and blues. There's just like color all over the place.
Yeah. It's a very nuanced film in terms of its color palette, but it isn't afraid to go extreme with it. Like, we, you know, the key scene, which everyone kind of, I think, knows from To Catch a Thief, is the scene where Grace Kelly and Cary Grant are kind of flirting in her apartment or in her hotel room. And there are fireworks outside on the beach.
Oh, yeah.
And Cary Grant is assuming that the thief will be here soon, so he turns the lights off. But it's not just...
Oh, fuck.
It's not just, like, turning the lights off because the thief is on its way and they want to act like they're not there. It's also, I'm going to turn the lights off because Alfred Hitchcock wants me to turn the lights off so we can get a better view of this green color palette and these beautiful fireworks.
Yeah.
And it's true. You know, this movie is all about, like, the vibe isn't like 100%. Let's turn the lights off in the room and really emphasize the contrast between like the green, the blue-green look of the hotel room and how it's all lit and staged. Mm-hmm. And then this gorgeous display of white light that's coming from the fireworks outside.
Yeah, there's a really smart moment in that scene too, where Grace Kelly is like, she's wearing these diamonds, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she keeps saying to Cary Grant, like, I know you're, you know, my eyes are up here, basically.
Yeah.
But when they turn the lights off, she like steps back to lean on this table, and like her whole face up to her neck is in shadow. And the only thing you know, and then the rest of her body's in the light, but yeah. specifically those diamonds, the diamonds around her neck.
That's all.
And it's like, mm-hmm. oh, dude, that's so smart.
Yeah.
And it just looks incredible.
It's like a moment that is totally like, it's obvious when you see it, but like you could easily just be like so into the movie that that's not even something you notice.
Yeah.
You know, Hitchcock was great at just these little flourishes that mm-hmm. call no attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. It's just like within the style of the picture.
And that could have been left out too. Like they could have just not done that moment and the movie would still be just as good.
Yeah.
But then that's like, oh God, you're a master.
He's so, he's just like, just his images are wonderful to look at, and mm-hmm. how he stages everything is just a joy to watch. And especially in a movie like this, where it's so light and funny and, you know, it's full of just hanging out with rich people and just, you know, just living life and caught in a crime little caper. You know, there's a little problem with the jewel thief. Uh-oh. You know, there's nothing substantial about it mm-hmm. in terms of the narrative, but the way it's put together is of course just stunning to look at and to just be in the vibe.
Totally. The compositions too, you know, are also really incredible. There's one where Cary Grant's sitting in this office and he's like framed by like this lamp and a phone that are like in the foreground out of focus. Mm-hmm. And it's just like so interesting. And then that makes me think of Dial M for Murder.
Yeah.
You know, and how that's like, well, first of all, isn't it crazy that that movie was made to be 3D?
Yeah.
In the 50s?
Yeah, it's wild.
This is the thing that just blows my mind about the history of movies and this art, you know, mm-hmm. where it's like the thing I said about the color, it's like I thought color came in way later than it did, you know, and then I thought 3D was like an 80s thing or whatever. I'm sure there was maybe something before, you know, Jaws 3, Friday the 13th, you know.
The first 3D craze was in, you know, there was a lot of it. I mean, to be fair, like, you know, there was 3D in the 40s.
It's crazy. It's like, how can you even have 3D if there's no color?
Yeah.
You know, like,
no, like, I mean, red and green was a thing in like not even before 1920.
What?
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. The anaglyph or whatever it's called, you know, the so those are like the two different colors.
Okay. Okay.
So, you know, like I think the initial patent was a fucking long time ago.
Wow.
You know, I'm no expert on like how 3D is, but it is interesting how these things come back in different ways. And of the people who, you know, are just growing up, like when I was growing up, Avatar was like, that was 3D.
Yeah.
You know, like mm-hmm. I saw, or maybe it was, I think I saw Polar Express in 3D, you know, like those.
Yeah. My Bloody Valentine.
I didn't see that at the time, but I should have. Yeah. My dad should have let me in. but like, yeah, the idea of these movies, you know, you're growing up and like that's the thing that you associate with it, even if it's not the first thing.
Yeah.
Right? But to think about how like, oh my God, like imagine just seeing Dial M for Murder, a movie that isn't really about, you know, shit flying at the screen. It's about the claustrophobia of that one space.
Yes. Yeah, you know? Yeah, totally. That's why I was so like, how does this even make sense? You know, and then I remember watching it and being like, okay, I see how this like lamp would look closer to me sitting here, you know, because it's in the foreground. Mm-hmm. And Grace Kelly's in the background. Mm-hmm. I remember Christopher Nolan saying something years back about like, movies are already 3D. Like we're already getting that illusion from a regular movie, like mm-hmm. the depth, you know, because it's like there is no depth, the image is just on the screen. And I remember being like at the time being like, I get that, but like the anaglyph deal with mm-hmm. the glasses or whatever, it's like it really has this different effect.
Totally.
Which I feel like over time, I went to see Jurassic Park in 3D when it was re-released in, what was that, 2014?
It was
like the 20 year
I think it was 2012. It must have been.
Sure.
It came out in 93.
Oh, okay.
So 2013. Yeah. I saw that 4 times. That
You're
re-release.
Insane.
I literally one weekend, I just went. I just kept going back. It's so good.
Over time, my brain, I feel like, gets used to the 3D, mm-hmm. Illusion. So even in the theater with the glasses, with a great projection, it's still okay, by the end of the movie, it's pretty flat again,
Right.
But now I feel like I agree with Christopher Nolan where it's don't even do 3D, because it's or I feel like I'm getting the more mature I get, the more I'm we don't need all this hokey garbage.
I love 3D. I go through phases with it. I think as the general public does. I think it can be around so much that people, not only do people lose the effect because they're seeing everything in 3D and they kind of get used to it, but they also are seeing movies that don't necessarily bring anything to the table.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see a movie in 3D for a while. And then I saw The Way of Water, first screening.
Same.
In 3D.
We saw it together.
Yeah. And the rain and mm-hmm. the jungle,
mm-hmm.
In the front layer of the mm-hmm. frame, and the depth of the branches, the sight lines of the guns when people are shooting.
Yeah.
How when flare is popping out from the gun and it's in this in-between space. I was just overwhelmed by it. And, mm-hmm. That's the kind of movie that now and then it's that is just going to give me that much more of the immersion of the experience.
Totally. Yeah.
But that's also a movie that was shot for 3D in mind.
Yes.
And James Cameron is someone who respects 3D and respects the technical capabilities of it.
Stereoscopic.
It's not like they make a movie and then they send it to the 3D processing house and they change it up and then it goes out there. It's no, he knows what people want to see with that.
A thing I liked about The Way of Water is seeing there's a train or, some big train thing gets exploded in the beginning
mm-hmm.
and it flies at the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I love just thinking of the train arriving at the station in whatever 1899 or 1901 or whatever year that was, mm-hmm. One of the first things that freaked people out about movies. And then it's we're still throwing trains at the audience, over 100 years later, if you see a train in a movie, that director loves the history of film.
Yeah.
Least that's my interpretation. The Fablemans too. Seeing the train. There's some train scenes in that where I'm dude, the first movie.
The train is still very much associated as a symbol of progress, right?
Yeah.
When the railroad was being built in America, this idea that America was being more civilized or whatever, mm-hmm. Manifest Destiny was mm-hmm. taking its grip and, we were wiping out the fucking country of, of its native people. But, it happens.
Yeah.
But this idea that there's this, Jesus. There's this horrendous push towards progress, right?
Mm.
And in America, that is symbolized in both positive and negative ways. And mm-hmm. the train is this idea of look where we can go now.
Yeah.
Look where we can travel to. Look what we mm-hmm. can do.
Mm-hmm.
There's an idea of that. And I think the movies often represent the train as when you see that, you understand where we are. You understand what this time period is. Especially when you see the steam trains,
Yeah.
And you watch, if you've ever seen Gore Verbinski's The Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp and Armie Hammer,
mm-hmm.
that's a movie that uses trains a lot. And it does feel for as problematic as the usage of Johnny Depp as a Native American is, it is a film about the plight of Native Americans and how their struggle is often overlooked in terms of the great narratives of the West.
Yeah.
So it is interesting how trains fall into that frequently. But there's no trains in To Catch a Thief after our long tangent about 3D and Manifest Destiny and all that. There's not a train to be found, I don't think. Yeah, it's all boats.
Yeah, boats, planes.
Yeah,
cars.
Yep, it's we're in the 50s now, baby. No mm-hmm. trains to be found. You don't mm-hmm. need that. You get in a plane.
Yeah,
you get in a plane. You fly to wherever you want to go.
There's the part later in like the gala.
Yeah.
There's some really cool costumes in there and like textures and again colors. Grace Kelly is wearing this like gold dress.
Yeah.
And then her hair is like coated in gold. It took me a moment to even recognize that because I was just like looking at so much all of the other parts of the images. Because she has blonde hair, you know, so yeah. It's like I kind of didn't recognize it. And it's like, oh my God, look, her hair is gold. It's like, oh my God.
You kind of have to think like, her character is interesting because she's, you know, she's like, oh, my dad didn't know that we were sitting on a pile of oil, mm-hmm. you know, like on a shit ton of money because of the oil under our property. So she likes to act like she just like fell into this money, which like she did, mm-hmm. but then she's like, yeah, I just picked up this costume and it's like yeah. the most elaborate costume you've ever yeah. seen.
Yeah, she says like her and her mother are like, people of the land or something like that. Or, you know, she's like, we're common people, even yeah. though like we got all this money now, you know, like we're still just like regular people.
It's like, on one hand, sure. But on the other hand, like, no.
Yeah.
Like once you have that money, that's who you are.
Yeah. I did like, the characters like, Grace Kelly's character and, her mother, because they're like smart ladies. You know, Grace Kelly, like, figures out who John Roby, you know, Cary Grant's character, figures out that he's the cat burglar. Because he meets them as, you know, with an alias. And then Grace Kelly figures it out, you know. And she's, like, very persistent about that. He's this guy, you know, and she wants to, like, be involved in the caper or whatever.
Yeah.
But I like that. They're like smart lady characters, you know? Yeah. And yeah, they're like flirty, and even the mother's like flirty, you know?
Yeah.
But then they like kind of help him and they're on his side and they believe him or whatever. And, you know, I like that they're not just like, it feels like there's some more care to the female character, especially for like the time.
Totally. Yeah, there's like a couple of bad moments where Cary Grant says something about spanking her.
Yeah.
And it's like, good Lord, like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
But it, for most of the time, her characterization and for her and the mother are good. Like, and yeah. I agree with you. There's like a sense of like, they're not posh. Like a lot of the other older women in this are very like cartoonishly characterized as like posh and rich and like almost like bumbling buffoons kind
mm-hmm.
of like so rich that they just like don't notice when like their precious jewels are stolen.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been like trying to hold back from saying Freddy got fingered when he's talking about jewels. Do you remember that? Where he's like jewels.
I remember don't remember this? That reference.
We'll have to watch it.
Yeah.
But every time I say jewels, I think of Freddy got fingered.
Okay, great.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But proud of you. It's like, it's funny proud. How make your daddy proud.
Proud. Where's your LeBaron, Freddy?
Where's your LeBaron?
I fucked it up.
Cut that. Okay, cut it out. There, but you know, you kind of understand like how these characters are like going to be sympathetic to Cary Grant's plight because they're not like 100%.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
someone who like he would steal from. Yeah. He likes them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like he doesn't steal anymore. But the movie gives us enough of a characterization with them that he's like more interested in them and doesn't see them as just like the one percenters that.
Yeah,
all their like jewels mark. Are insurance. They have insurance on them. It's fine.
Yeah,
like he's not, you know, he's not stealing from the poor.
Right,
and there's never really a sense of that. Mm-hmm. So, I really do enjoy that this movie like it takes every possible avenue to not be like intense or upsetting yeah. or complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh, these people are nice. Mm-hmm. Let's like have them like be in the movie for a while.
Yeah. There is in that gala scene, there's an interesting sort of controversy or whatever with the costume that Cary Grant wears.
Yeah, it's not good.
Because he's like being snuck into this party.
Right.
Where there's tons of rich people, tons of jewels.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's going to try to scope out and who's doing the deed, you know, but also they don't want, there's cops there too. So like, he doesn't want to get caught. So he's in this like full, you know, all of his body is covered.
Yeah.
And he's in this like servant role. Cause like the theme of the gala is like royal society or something. So
right.
Everyone's being like King Louis, the whatever, you know? It's like the, you know, the wigs, the, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
That kind of era. But so he comes in as this like servant or whatever, and it's basically blackface. Like,
yeah,
it's a full black mask. It covers his whole head and neck. His shirt and pants are black. The costume is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like,
it is taken out of the circumstance, which was normally associated with a lot of blackface, which was these white performers put it on and then they perform, you know, a minstrel dance or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like Al Jolson or whatever.
Oh, sure.
You know, yeah. Or not Gene Kelly, but Fred Astaire
mm-hmm.
has done mm-hmm. did that in the past. So it's like, you know, it isn't like a performance. So like on one hand, like I definitely like it's like kind of in the background, but then yeah. like he like is like in it a lot in that climax, and it's just yeah. kind of like, it's just not fun to look at. And yeah. as much as it isn't like actual black makeup,
yeah,
the mask itself is basically the same thing.
It's pure black.
Yeah.
And he's got this like headdress on. He's got this incredible purple like cloak.
Yeah.
It's a cool costume, but it does kind of evoke some kind of like, well,
there's also like young like children of like a non-white, I don't know like what you know what association they are,
yeah, yeah.
but they have these young children dressed up as servants too, and yeah. like carrying these like
the sides of a dress of one of the people that comes in, and they're like, they look like the only like black people in the whole movie basically.
Yeah. So like, you know, this is a movie that as much as it is kind of parodying and like playing around with like lampooning high society, yeah. and Cary Grant is not someone who is a part of that as much as like he got rich off of stealing from them.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he prides himself as not being one of those type of people.
Mm-hmm.
It also doesn't interrogate it enough, you know,
yeah.
but it is of the 1950s and, mm-hmm. but like, it is kind of, it's just like kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth when you're like watching the ending and you're just having such a good time with this
yeah.
movie. And then you like, that hits you and it's kind of like, mm-hmm. ugh, gross.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit. It's like, why couldn't it have been a different color?
Yeah. Well, it's like Swing Time is a beautiful Fred Astaire movie.
Oh, okay.
And it just has a blackface number in it, you know? It just, and yeah. it's just like, yeah, here comes my next number. And you're like, shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's just so pleasurable until you get to that point.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want, that's just not something that I want to see anymore. And as much as I know it's, with classic films to compartmentalize or whatever,
oh,
and
yeah.
you know, and try to remove it from whatever
sure.
this time period is, it's still like, you know, we're not critics, we're not academics
yeah.
in the sense of you know, presenting this within its historical
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. mores of the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can just say that we don't like looking at it.
Yeah.
That's all we need to do.
Yeah. And I think to your point too of like the you know, taking it easy on this film, you know, is like, in the terms of making it, you know, and kind of just Hitchcock walking through it or whatever, like, yeah, not really giving that an attention to be like, maybe we shouldn't do this, or maybe it should be a little different, or like, or have it in there and whatever, you know, kind of, it's like, it slips through,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I don't think Hitchcock ever had that consideration. I don't know too much about his early work and if there's anything else that's racially insensitive or racist in them. But, you know, I mean, his treatment of women in films really,
yeah.
really varies.
And just white people are fucking in everything all the time only. Right. You know, so.
Definitely. You know, it's of its time for sure. No excuse, just a very easy way to, you know, put it within a frame of reference, I guess. But yeah, I mean, literally most of the time this movie is gleefully easy to watch. It's just like every so often Cary Grant will be like, "You need a spanking."
I needed the help of a woman.
The help of a woman. Well, good. I'm glad you got that, dude. And there's also there's just some weird things that's like so 1950s. Like when someone says the word milksop.
Milksop. Yeah, I just was seeing that in my notes. Yeah,
I
didn't look
that up. I don't know what that's about. I'm not even going to consider what milksop means.
Well, I was thinking in the context of like that dialogue that it's like, you know, someone who's boring or like a wet blanket or something, you know, like sop up the milk.
I'm going to start using that and be like, you're a fucking milksop.
You know, I was thinking.
I don't want it to like mean anything bad.
Shit. Yeah.
You know. Maybe it was like we should Google this, and unless it's like, it's a person who's indecisive and lacks courage.
Okay.
It's British slang. Yeah. I don't think it's a slur or anything. So yeah. I think you're good. Okay. But
I want to start saying naturally, because they say that a lot in this movie and in Vertigo. A little
naturally. Time.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's cool, and we could bring that back. You know, I think it's been 100 years since this movie's been made, so we're good.
Go ahead.
Oh, just I was going to say the night, how they have, like, the color of the night is green in this movie, which is very interesting.
So gorgeous.
It looks
very
so cool.
Bava. We were talking about Bava.
You know, there's this technique, day for night, that a lot of these older movies used to do, where, like, they'd shoot something during the day, but then just, like, put this blue tint over the whole...
That has a few of this, for sure. Like, that scene where they capture the guy.
Yeah.
And they kill him in the water. That's, like, so clearly day for night that it... Like, it looks so cheap. Like, it, you know... It,
you can tell.
Often, day for night, I enjoy as, like, a personal kind of affectation. It's an aesthetic choice that was done often for just budgetary reasons.
Yeah.
But like now, since we hardly get day for night, I feel like the last thing that was maybe day for night was Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah. I was honestly gonna bring up that scene that is nighttime where it's like you see that stilt character like
that's
walking.
Day for night.
Dude, that blue color is like, oh man, that's like maybe my favorite color, blue.
All that stuff in that blue is day for night, and it's stunning because you recognize it as an aesthetic choice, that one that isn't just because of budget but because of how it looks.
Yeah.
And I feel like we should bring that back, just like how we bring black and white for the aesthetic reasons. There is a sense of that being intensely, you know, kind of, you know, there's a budgetary distinction for it in this movie.
To make it green, though, I feel like is so interesting.
Yeah, it's like it kind of matches how the rooftop scenes look, too.
Yeah.
It's like this aqua blue green
that
I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with the color in this movie. I just love looking at it. So
it's insane. It's
so
like,
awesome.
It's just like, don't even care about what this movie's about. Just literally... look at the colors.
Just bask in the VistaVision.
Dude, mute the TV, put on some French acoustic guitar or whatever, you know, sip a tea, sip some coffee or whatever, have a cigarette.
No, if you're like, your heart rate's raising at all while you're watching this, like, just lower it back down. Like, this movie's not meant to be really exciting. Just watch it. Bask in the vibes. That's all you really need to do.
When we were looking up the 4K and we were seeing some of those contrasting images, like I guess that 4K turns a lot of that green to blue. So it looks more like a day for night kind of blue. But then it's like, the movie was green, and that's like such a choice, you know? Like, when is the nighttime ever green?
I feel like it just isn't. I was reading a lot of mixed reviews about that new release from Paramount, and Paramount's pretty hit or miss when it comes to their 4K material. And it just sucks that, like, apparently the scan was right and everything was, like, you know, they did everything properly. It's just when it got to the color timing phase, I don't know if they were looking at reference prints or something that wasn't the original negative, or or they had some sort of insider info as to how it was supposed to look. But
yeah,
I hate how it looks. It's unfortunate because a lot of 4K's 4K market is the best that the home video market has ever been.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, there's still some duds.
I just
watched True Lies. That was a dud.
Oh, damn.
Like every face in it looks like a fucking wax figure.
Didn't that not even have a Blu-ray?
No, it had a DVD. Both The Abyss and True Lies had a DVD. And they were both non-anamorphic DVDs at that.
Jimmy Cam's
coming in with his digital tinkering as usual.
He's like, oh, I'm going to make a whole new technology to make these home videos even better. Just like invent something that hasn't been yet.
But yeah, I mean, overall, the 4K market is pretty astounding. And when we watched Vertigo, that's like one of the transfers. It's just absolutely drop dead gorgeous.
I bet To Catch a Thief looks incredible too. But like, if you didn't know that blue is supposed to be green, you know.
Yeah, it's like,
it probably wouldn't change that much. It would maybe make more sense because you'd be like, oh yeah, it's nighttime, that's blue.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know how much of it would actually take away from the aesthetic experience of watching it, because I do love how this movie looks and feels when I watch it.
But
and
I the want blue, that green.
The Blu-ray was looking mighty fine, honestly.
Blu-ray is great.
It was good. But Corey,
let's
wrap this up.
Sure.
They've listened to us long enough. would you give this one another look? Would you recommend it?
Absolutely.
Cool.
It's so cool. I'm so glad we got to watch this one. I think it's really only my second viewing, actually. But I bought it and I loved it right when I watched it, you know, and then, yeah, it was an easy choice. You know, this is definitely a movie that's going to be at your local library, our new sponsor. You know, tell your local librarian, give them the code Another Look at checkout to have your entire purchase free, or your entire selection is going to be completely free.
Library card required.
But, oh man, watch this movie. Everybody out there, go watch To Catch a Thief. It's so great.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Hitchcock films are so vast and varied. There's a great many of them that I feel like people don't talk about that I love. Under Capricorn with Ingrid Bergman is one that I absolutely adore, and I feel like people just don't watch it for whatever reason. He made so many movies. I get it. And it's easy to cling to the major ones because they are indeed major films.
I haven't even seen a bunch of the big ones still, like Notorious and
Crazy Good.
So, you know, I was looking up some of his other ones and just feeling like, oh my God, there's so many.
Yeah, no.
He's got so many more movies.
He was a workhorse, and he worked like he was just a journeyman, you know, just like someone, you know, making movies, not even a care in the world about his personal style, but he developed such a unique and influential state of cinema. Honestly, and so this cool. This one is just really enjoyable and light and bubbly and makes me want to book a plane flight to France.
Yeah,
as if that was possible for me. Right now.
You know, summer's right around the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll just hang out outside, you know, plant a garden.
Yeah, steal some jewels.
Yeah, just have a nice romp through the countryside.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Corey.
Yeah.
On-air handshake.
As always, pleasure doing business with you.
Yes, sir. And everybody, be on the lookout for more episodes from Another Look.
See you later.
See you later.